Edwina Farley. This morning, we'll find out why insect milkshakes could be your choice of protein drink sooner than you think.
There is a fast food company in the States that's about 100 restaurants that have done really, really good business over the last few months by offering a Oreo chocolate protein shake with Chilean crickets as part of the components there, and, you know, claiming a certain number of crickets, I think it's in the 90s, in every protein shake sold.
Not sure how you upsize one of those. You're the country breakfast. We'll have more on insects later. Kath McAloon's got all the big stories of the week, though, first for Rural News. And Kath, wow, there wasn't a headline that didn't contain the word sausage or bacon midweek. Some pretty interesting statements from the World Health Organization about meat and cancer.
The World Health Organization's research arm, which looks particularly at cancer, it's the International Agency for Research on Cancer, said this week that there was sufficient evidence that eating processed meat caused colorectal cancer, while unprocessed red meat was also classified as a probable carcinogen. So not a good week for bacon and sausage lovers. And the response from the meat industry in Australia has been a bit muted, I guess. Neither Meat and Livestock Australia, Australian Pork Limited, or the Australian Meat Industry Council would be interviewed in response to this report. But in a statement, MLA said it was guided by Australian dietary guidelines, which recommend that eating red meat is part of a balanced diet. The Agriculture Minister, however, Barnaby Joyce, did have something to say on this report. In fact, he played down the findings of the report.
If you're going to avoid everything that has any correlation with cancer whatsoever, don't walk outside, don't walk down the streets in Sydney. There's going to be very little in life that you actually do in the end. If you got everything that the World Health Organization said was carcinogenic and took it out of your daily requirements, we are kind of heading back to a cave.
With some interesting and reasonably heated hearings following on from the Senate's inquiry into the Murray-Darling Basin plan this week in New South Wales.
Yeah, the Senate inquiry, which is looking into whether the Murray-Darling Basin plan fairly balances the environmental, social and economic needs of the communities affected, heard submissions this week in two New South Wales cities. It went to Broken Hill earlier in the week and then to Griffith later in the week. You'll remember that Griffith is where protesters famously burnt copies of the Basin Plan ahead of its implementation in 2012. There was some really fiery scenes back there 3 years ago. Not as much heat, I guess, this week when the Senate inquiry was back there, although local councils that came along to the hearing there told the Senate committee that communities in the region were sick of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. They claimed that they were seeing little benefit from the plan. They also claimed that even environmental benefits were small and that the communities were being bled dry with people leaving and that sort of thing. While in Broken Hill, the town there is facing a shortage of drinking water, and some community members there actually blame both upstream and downstream irrigators for the crisis that they're facing. One of the local residents in Broken Hill who gave evidence to the inquiry during the week was Stan Deneen, and he said it was really important that the process was fair to everyone.
We've got to have empathy for each other and understand each other's position. It's no good saying I'm wrong or you're wrong or this place right. We've got to just stop and look at everyone's problems and try and sort them out in a sustainable way.
Yeah, there's a reason that it took decades to get any kind of national water plan in place. Still sort of talking about water, I suppose, and contamination from toxic chemicals.
Yeah, this issue's been in the news for a little while, but it's sort of broadened out this week with a federal MP claiming that toxic leaks of chemicals from Air Force bases were likely to exist right across the country. It's due to chemicals that were used in firefighting foams that were once used at sites, and they've been detected in groundwater near the Williamtown RAAF base in New South Wales and also at Oakey in regional Queensland. Experts say that the human health impacts are minimal, but this contamination issue's had big issues for local fishermen, particularly around Williamtown. Just this week, the New South Wales government extended a ban on fishing in those areas for another 8 months. So that's left local fishermen without an income. And now the Liberal member for Paterson, which is in that area, Bob Baldwin, he's calling for the government to provide emergency funding relief for businesses and families in that electorate.
Well, I believe this is an issue. Everywhere they have done firefighting training in particular, whether it's a military base, a commercial airport, or indeed other areas where firefighting has been, training has been done, where they've used this phone.
An important update from the Bureau this week.
The Bureau's released their long-term outlook, which sort of gives an indication of what weather we can expect from November through until January. And they're predicting that November will be warmer than average in the southern parts of Australia. And they're also saying we can expect below average rainfall across southeastern Australia, as well as parts of the north of Australia. But in the country's west, large parts of sort of the western Australia will get more rain than usual, so a bit wetter over there. The long-term outlook, which is for the next 3 months, it predicts below average rainfall for that entire 3 months across Victoria, New South Wales and also in the tropics. And there's a lot of interest in the weather at the moment, particularly for crop farmers that are getting ready to harvest, and a lot of them have had sort of unseasonably hot weather. But in southern Queensland this week, there was another weather event which caused some concern for farmers in the region. There were severe hailstorms which struck the Western Downs on Wednesday afternoon. The massive storm there dumped large volumes of hail stones, and these destroyed some melon crops. They also caused damage for cereal crops. Terry O'Leary is a melon grower in the area, and he says the biggest issue now will be the risk of fungal disease.
It'll be really going flat out with our spray program non-stop over the next 4 or 5 days, probably twice a day, just to make sure that we can try and get on top of any infections, because if they do get in there and get a hold with the stress plant, they won't really rebound very well, and it'll probably end up costing the crop then.
There's some exploration going on in South Australia's Gawler Ranges.
Yeah, a bit of a positive for the mining industry, I guess, which is not enjoying good times at the moment.
You don't hear the word explore, do
you?
No,
you're not for a while. So there's a major new search for minerals, and that's set to begin in a volcanic province of the Gawler Ranges in South Australia. Minotaur Exploration will partner up with several government agencies for the project, and it's actually received $2 million in government funding to search in previously unexplored regions. Tony Belperio is from Minotaur. He says they'll be looking for silver, lead, zinc and gold, and he says they'll be aided by some new real-time technology which will make a big difference for the explorers.
What happens traditionally is you might drill a hole, send the samples away for 3 or 4 weeks to get analysed. In the meantime, the drill rig's gone, etc. So there's a huge cost, both in time and money, associated with that. But with these new real-time technologies, we can make those decisions on the spot.
A new rail line, which could be a bit of a game changer in the north.
Yeah, this comes as there's a lot of talk about developing Northern Australia for agriculture, and now the Northern Territory government has announced that it will commission a study to look into whether it's feasible to build a rail line between Katherine in the Territory and Kununurra in Western Australia. It would be really significant if it was built, because it would connect the Ord Irrigation Scheme with the North-South Rail Line, which already exists running between Adelaide and Darwin. And there's also plans to look at putting a link the other way across to Mount Isa. So you could see a fairly large and substantial rail network in that northern area, which is, of course, an area where the roads get washed out, which causes problems for agriculture in that area. Peter Chandler is the NT Minister for Transport, and he says that would benefit agriculture in both the Ord and the Katherine regions. And it would also benefit a proposed $1 billion prawn farm, which is going to be constructed at Lejeune Station.
And if we really are serious, if the federal government, if the Western Australian government, Queensland, and of course the Northern Territory government is serious about growing the north, these are the type of infrastructure projects we've got to commit to demonstrate quite clearly that we are serious and that we want to see the north develop.
And one of my favourite foods of all time. Gosh, I wish I could have been there. Cheese tasting.
Yeah, some of the best Australian cheeses. More than 100 of them were judged this week as part of the Australian Dairy Industry Awards. So these really are the best of the best. They sort of have local competitions around the country, and then the winners of those come together to be judged in the Australian Dairy Industry Awards. A man who has an enviable job is one of the judges, Russell Smith. He also judges cheese competitions in Asia and the US. Now, Mr. Smith says that there are signs that demand for premium Australian cheese in North America, which had fallen away because of the previously high Australian dollar, it may be increasing again, so we might have to share our cheese around.
If the dollar stays around where it is, we'll certainly see in the next 5 years a huge increase in interest in Australian cheeses. There's a few that have got widespread distribution in the United States at the moment, but there'll be a lot more in another 3 or 4 years.
And we can guarantee that none of it will come from a can.
Yeah, exactly. Or a tube.
Yes,
that's weird.
Yes, terrifying. Kath, thank you.
Thank you.
Kath McAloon with the week's Rural News. You can check out all those stories and a whole lot more at abc.net.au/rural.
The Arts Channel on ABC iView.
What are we looking for today?
What we want to find.
A world of art and culture at your fingertips.
I know when I'm going to write a song. I just get a feeling that I'm going to write a song.
Design, documentaries, film, books, music, interviews, fashion.
We like to think of it as a talking show.
Discover the arts in all its forms.
From feature films to web series to video art.
The Arts Channel on ABC iView, where life and culture collide.
You're with a Country Breakfast right here on RN. Let's join our rural reporters. In today's program, an exciting week for ornithologists and volunteer twitchers on the hunt for an endangered bird species in the Northern Territory. Ever wondered how smaller boutique vineyards manage to get their wine into a bottle ready for sale? Well, they call in the mobile bottler, of course. And we'll introduce you to the singing dairy farmer, Regan Tucker.
Seems to be as long as I've decided to be a farmer, it popped into my head. So I just sing in the tractor and on the motorbike, getting the cows in all the time. Sing to the cows. Sometimes I may not like it, so they'll let me know.
And singing to his cows has paid off. Regan has made the country music charts in the United States. You'll hear his story a bit later. But first today, we're going bird spotting in Kakadu National Park.
We were around this way yesterday. That's that very top section you can see.
Yep.
So, yeah, so what we'll do, we'll go back around to the right today and head back towards Rachel.
Senior Parks Ranger Khan Spokes is leading the way as we go in search of a little yellow bird, once common but now very rare in the Northern Territory's top end. Hello, I'm Lisa Herbert. This time of year, the vast flat floodplains of Kakadu National Park are dry. There's the odd turtle skeleton lying on the ground. The grass and the few low shrubs I can see are all brown and crispy. It certainly doesn't look like a birdwatcher's paradise. But as they say, looks can be deceiving. And if we're lucky today, we will find evidence of the endangered yellow chat.
Mind if we walk over there?
I'm joined on my very first bird survey by experienced Brisbane-based ornithologist Chris Sanderson. He and a team of volunteer bird watchers have been here all week surveying the park.
So we call it pishing, and basically it sort of simulates an alarm call for small birds. So often what will happen if you do it is the little birds will come out of their hiding place and check you out. You've got to use it sparingly. You don't use it when there's a bird of prey that eats other birds that's circling around, because you might put the birds in danger. But it's a useful little trick that you can use to get a look at these small birds.
Chris, what have you spotted?
Some potential habitat. We've got a bit of residual water in the landscape, and looks like some complex vegetation rather than just the flat grassland, so it could be good for the chats. We're hoping that when we approach these habitat types, we actually flush the birds up into the higher points in the vegetation.
And the vegetation's only chest height, max.
Yeah, and that's the most we're going to get today. Anything higher than this will be trees, and that means we're not in the right spot. So we're absolutely trying to focus on these spots that have patches of sesbania in amongst the floodplain grassland areas.
Describe this sesbania. It's a shrub?
Yeah, sesbania is this annual plant that gets knocked down when the rains come, and then it grows back up as the wetlands start to dry out, and it provides a bit of cover for the birds to hide in when predators come after them.
These yellow chats, why are they important?
Well, they're a native animal and they're beautiful. That shouldn't be the only reason that we conserve things. There are plenty of things that aren't beautiful that are also worthy of our attention. But in this case, it's a species or a subspecies that's only found in the Northern Territory. They're a fairly iconic bird for the Kakadu area and for the people of the Northern Territory. And they're in serious trouble. You know, they've gone from being a species that was common on the floodplains to something that we're now having to actively look for to even find one or two of them. So, you know, if we can understand where they're still occurring, we can actually target some management actions like culling pigs and things like that to hopefully help them out.
When was the last time that these birds were spotted, and in what quantities?
Well, there was a survey like this last year as part of Kakadu Bird Week, and they actually found, I think it was about 27 birds, and that was the first time they'd been seen for some time, well, at least in an official survey context. Hopefully the parks managers have been running into them from time to time, but, you know, it's not really their job to have to look for this stuff at the moment. So, you know, we're out here trying to do some formal surveys, and if we can get some good numbers for them, then they know where to look for them in future and to look after them.
Good numbers, what are they?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, you know, in other parts of their range, and for other subspecies, good numbers would be flocks of 400. You know, out here with an endangered subspecies, finding any is a good start.
So, Chris, after 1.5 hours of travelling, we finally got to a spot. We're walking back to the vehicle with, well, no excitement.
Oh, look, that's fine. You know, we're going to get a lot of zero records in this exercise. You know, that's part of the point. They're a rare bird. If they were everywhere, we wouldn't be surveying for them. This wasn't really appropriate habitat, but we needed to check it out just to make sure that they weren't here. We'll move on and hopefully they'll be at the next spot.
It's not all sunshine, birds and rainbows on this bird spotting expedition. Ranger Khan Spokes is here with us as well, driving the vehicle. And you've got a rifle over your arm. Tell us what that's for.
Just a bit of public safety. Make sure you guys are all safe. There's, this time of year, plenty of pigs and buffalo all congregating around the water. Same as the area we're looking, so it's a bit more of a safety issue.
So pigs and buffalo won't run away if they see us?
Pigs generally will unless they feel cornered. Buffalo, personalities, some will, some won't. Some will want to hang on to what they've got. It is that time of year where it's hot and any bit of water's worth hanging on to. So.
Obviously we're trying to find those water points to spot some of these birds, but I can't imagine these feral animals help those birds' habitat whatsoever.
No, the pig damages are quite severe in a lot of areas, and the buffalo's same thing, wallowing in the areas and turning it all over. That affects the ecosystem, the turtles, the insects, and the insects are what the birds are after, so yeah, it all has a ripple effect.
Well, Ranger Khan, let's hope you don't use that rifle.
It'd be nice not to.
Oh, look out! That was a big hole you just missed. Oh.
One of the hazards of looking for birds at the same time is driving through difficult terrain.
Extra degree of difficulty.
Oh, is that one?
Yeah.
All right, things just got exciting.
Yeah, so we've just flushed a young male yellow chat. This is the whole reason we're here. And it's very exciting to find one. Yeah, they're an endangered species, so it's pretty good to find one at all. You know what? There's definitely more chats.
Down that way?
Yeah, I've got one now.
Yours might be. It does look pretty yellow.
Yep.
I reckon we've got another few further on. So this is obviously the spot.
Chris, there's a big smile on your face and I just heard you say, I'm so stoked.
Absolutely. Look, you know, we've now found another group. I think it counts up to 5. So, you know, this is a pretty good result for us.
Were you expecting it in this location?
I guess my knowledge of chats is that this is the kind of stuff they're in, but I mean, anyone who was coming here for the first time who didn't know what they were all about would absolutely look at this and go, why is there anything here? There just doesn't look like there's anything for them.
You've been looking at the GPS since we left pretty much this morning. What's its role and why log where this bird is?
So with the GPS, we've got the sightings from last year on to come and check out those sites again to see if they're still here, and this is one of those spots, so it's really good news for us that they're still at one of the sites that they were found at last year. But we're also using an Android tablet with CyberTracker loaded on it, and we've got a form that lets us fill in all of the data that we're wanting to collect, lets us be a bit systematic, make sure we're collecting the same data each year so we can compare trends over time.
What data are you looking at?
So a little bit about the habitat, you know, whether there's Sesbania present and...
The elusive Sesbania, this low-growing shrub.
That's right, and there is a little bit here. It's mostly dead. There's a few short thickets of it growing back up, obviously just enough to keep the chats happy.
So where to now? We've spotted a few. We're going to walk towards further into the habitat.
Yeah, well, I've seen a few sentinel birds that are sort of keeping their eyes on us, but I reckon if we walk over to this lot, there might be more than the three that I've seen so far. So we just need an accurate count now.
So sentinel birds, they're the ones who obviously just keep watch. They're the security guards.
That's right. Any small bird that lives in a flock tends to have at least one bird that it takes its turn to keep its eye out to see if something's coming that could potentially harm them. So they'll take it in turns, but there's always one keeping an eye out.
I can hear some black kites above. Is that of concern to them?
Look, black kites, probably not. There are a lot of birds of prey. I mean, you've seen today we've looked at hobbies trying to catch cisticolas and there's been some black-shouldered kites flying around. There's a number of birds of prey out here that would happily eat a yellow chat if they could get their claws on it.
And what about cats? Feral cats are obviously an issue right across Australia. Are they here?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Khan over there managed to shoot one yesterday that was actually stalking some birds while they were watching. So cats are a huge issue out here. You know, obviously with the birds of prey, this is something that these birds have evolved to cope with over many, many millions of years, whereas the cats are something that they've only just started dealing with for the first time, and they're very bad at detecting them and avoiding them. So cats are a big issue, and hopefully eventually we'll come up with a good way of dealing with them.
Let's go find some more yellow chats.
All right, seven.
So Ranger Khan, do you get a finder's fee? Seven so far?
That'd be nice, but that's just a joy to see them. I mean, a lot of our work isn't involved in environmental stuff as doing research, so the opportunity to come out and see these. I've been here over 4 years now. It's the first chance I've had to come out and do this, so that's a buzz.
Is this the first yellow chat you've seen?
It is, absolutely. Well, the first one I know of. I may have seen them previously and just not known a thing about them, but it's a real buzz to see them. There's been a lot of kilometres put into to find them so far, and to come up with seven in one patch is brilliant.
A successful end to a week of bird spotting in Kakadu National Park. Senior Ranger Khan Spokes ending that report from our new resident rural twitcher, Lisa Herbert. Still to come on Rural Reporter today, some tunes from Tasmania's singing dairy farmer, and a mobile bottling plant helps boutique wineries get their wine to a bottle shop near you.
There is no difference. The only thing is that because we deal with so many different people, that is on a daily basis, we're at a different winery. So it's more about the headspace than what it is about the bottling line.
Australia's wine industry is made up of thousands of small boutique wineries. Most of them operate on very small margins, so they're always looking at ways to keep their costs down. And that's where this mobile bottling plant comes into its own. Hello, I'm Michael Kavanagh. For the past 13 years, Des Prophet and his crew have been driving around the wine-growing regions of southern New South Wales. They simply back this specially modified semi-trailer into a winery and hook themselves up.
On a fixed plant, most of those would do larger volumes of wine. For one company, we used to bottle over 38,000 bottles of wine in a day. However, today we're only bottling 20,000 bottles. And though it's three different bottle shapes and three different wines and three different labels, we'll still have that done, I would estimate, by about 3:45 this afternoon.
When you first started this, how hard was it to convince wineries that it could work?
Oh, yes, that was a lot of fun, but the bottling aspect of it isn't difficult. As soon as they saw what we were doing, word of mouth soon, our business just grew to the point where we have people waiting for days for bottling to be done.
What sort of area do you cover when you are bottling?
Well, we normally get home on a Friday night and leave again at lunchtime on Sunday. We bottle the Mudgee region around Orange. Probably a third of our business is around Canberra and a little bit in Barrel. That takes up all year.
You can be on the road virtually 12 months of the year bottling for the different wineries.
Oh, we normally spend 200 nights of the year in a motel. So when you wake up at 1 o'clock in the morning and have to go to the toilet, you have to stop and think, where is the toilet?
Protruding from the side near the front of the semi is what can best be described as a lazy Susan. Pallets of empty bottles are forklifted up into the trailer. The bottles are then placed by hand onto a continuously moving conveyor belt ready to be filled, sealed and labelled. They emerge at the back of the truck ready to be packed into boxes for sale. Today, Des Prophet and his team are working at the Lerida Estate Winery overlooking Lake George, just north of Canberra. Like many jobs, this one involves bottling different varieties of wine on the same day. In this case, Botrytis and Rosé.
How difficult is it, though, to juggle at the peak time of bottling? The wineries must be wanting you all at the same time.
We've picked out certain clients that we bottle for, and we respect those clients. That's based on the people that supported us from the start. And that's why we bottle over quite a vast area. That way the vintage comes in at different times, so we have the wines tend to be spread out a bit. So when we started the 015 vintage in April, we spent a lot of that time in the Canberra region. We then moved on to Mudgee, and Orange comes in last.
You're doing three today. What's the largest number of different wines you've had to bottle in one day?
There's a winery out of Murrum Bateman that we held the record at for a long time. We did 19 wines there. However, we went out to Dubbo and we did 22 wines there. By the end of the day, he had run out of cartons. We'd used every plastic bin he had, and he rolled over the water tank, a big galvanised iron water tank, and one of my boys jumped inside the tank. We handed him bottles and he stacked his wine into the water tank.
Carefully watching on today is Malcolm Burdett. He's been Lerida's winemaker for the last 10 years. He says it makes financial sense to bring in the mobile bottling crew.
Just the cost factor, because you have to buy all the equipment and store it for about over 11 and a half months, and then you lose it for a couple of weeks. With a mobile bottling line, it just comes four times a year.
Is there much of an operation to set this one up as opposed to when you do have a plant that's fixed at a winery?
Well, there's very little to set up. It's all their equipment, so they set it up. I just got to get the wine ready to be bottled.
How much of that is a bit of an operation in itself, making sure that you've got the bottles there and the wine to time it for when they turn up?
Yeah, it's a bit of organisation to get all the bottles, the capsules, labels, all to tie in, and all the wine filtered.
When you're bottling different wines, such as a Shiraz, a white wine, or in this case, a Botrytis, and then you're setting up for another, does that present major problems?
No, not really. There's no major problems. They just backwash. If you've got a sweet wine, you just have to wash all the lines out and then put the next wine in. You bottle white before red.
For Des Prophet and his crew, when time allows, the job is not without its perks.
At the end of the day, when you shut the plant down, what do you enjoy to have a drink?
I love to try the wine that we bottled in the day, but our problem is that we will pack up, like tonight. We've got a 3-hour drive tonight. When I finally get out of the truck at night time, I love to have a glass of wine just to know what we've been bottling.
When I start singing, you got to tell me to shut up because I just keep singing. I'll sing Neon Moon by Brooks and Dunn. You ever heard of Brooks and Dunn? When the sun goes down on my side of town, and a lonesome feeling comes through my door, and the whole world turns blue.
Tasmanian farmer Regan Tucker was just 5 years old when he decided what he wanted to do with his life. He'd be a singer and a dairy farmer like his dad, and he's managed to fulfil both lifelong ambitions. Hello, I'm Rose Grant. Regan and his wife Alison now have their own dairy farm at Dunorland near Elizabethtown in northern Tasmania. And one of his songs is making it in the US charts. Well, like any good country singer, Regan takes inspiration from his surroundings. And one of the coldest winters in 50 years here in Tasmania is inspiring his next album, which will be called Stone Cold. Well, milking's done for this morning, so we've retreated to the warmth of the kitchen to find out where it all started for this singing dairy farmer.
Born on a dairy farm in New Zealand. My dad owns a farm in the Ngātahuatanga, which is just south of Hamilton, and that's where we were brought up. And just been a dream of mine to own a dairy farm since I was 5. Yeah, I just kept milking, and as I got to job, worked our way here, my wife and I, from the bottom to the top, yeah.
What's the bottom like?
Bottom's, as you can imagine, shoveling the bad stuff and pushing through.
So this is the top?
Yeah, pretty lucky to be here. We've got a platform of 280 acres, and we've been milking between 170 and 180 cows with all our young stock. So we've been here for just over 7 years.
Well, it's been a hard winter, hasn't it?
Yeah, snow sort of set us back a bit.
Did it actually settle down here?
Yeah, we got about a foot, and it was just like that for a couple of days, but that's the first time I've ever seen snow, so it's very interesting. Mm.
Now, you say you got the idea dairy farming was for you when you were knee-high to a Friesian cow?
Yeah. Yeah, that's how we all start off, I thought, but yeah, just brought up on a dairy farm and it sort of drummed into me.
And what about the singing? Because has that always been there? Been there for as long as that too?
Seems to be as long as I've decided to be a farmer, it popped into my head. So when I was about 5, I got recorded doing some school thing. And then I just sing in the tractor and on the motorbike, getting the cows in all the time. Sing to the cows. Sometimes they may not like it, so they'll let me know. But when I was in my younger day, I used to be into a bit of the old school Elvis Presley and rock and roll. And that was what I was brought up with, and Creedence Clearwater Revival, big influence on me. So I'm fairly old school on everything I do, and that flows through my album that I made, yeah.
So you play the guitar, you sing?
I try to play the guitar as best I can. I play the harmonica better. I wouldn't say I'm great. I got feedback from America with the 16th on the charts there for 6 weeks, so I'm pretty proud of that.
16th on the country charts?
Yeah, it's independent radio stations in America, and it's broadcasted from New York and Los Angeles, I think. It debuted at 32 and then fluctuated for 6 weeks, got to 16 for 3 weeks. I was at 16. To get there is a big confidence boost for me, and it's made me hungry for more.
So we better have a listen, hadn't we?
Yep, I'll get it for you.
Dreams just like a river, ever changing as it flows. And the dreamer's just a vessel that must follow where it goes. Try again to learn.
We were saying before, you're kind of inspired by, well, a lot of the greats of country music, yeah, and yeah, pretty traditional, but is that what you sing to your cows?
Yeah, that more. A lot of different variations of music, eh?
Yeah, because you'd have something to call them up and something to keep them...
More aggressive sort of music like Chuck Berry, you know. Chuck Berry's song, a couple of Alan Jackson and George Strait on there too.
Yeah, and with you heard, I mean, are they named after country music greats? You don't have a Dolly Parton and an Emmy Lou Harris in your herd?
No, they've only got numbers, unfortunately, but it's a good idea, good idea.
And what do you milk them to?
What do I milk the cows to?
Yeah.
I write a lot of my own songs, so on my third album that's coming out, it'll be all my music. And I write songs randomly while I'm milking, so I'll pull out a notebook and I'll listen to the rhythm in my head. It sounds kind of strange, I know, but I get my music from the farm, you see.
So what would be an example?
I suppose it's like we were talking about the snow before and the cold and the down payout, you know, that's what inspires me. It's the adrenaline I get from the pain of life in general. And far being a farmer, you don't get thanked much. You know, you thank yourself, your wife might thank you, but this is a 24/7 job, and if you don't love it, well, you don't last. And I wrote songs like my album will be called Stone Cold. I
mean, oh, we know about that.
So what are we talking about there? We're not just talking about the weather. We're talking about life in general, the money situation. You know, nobody really cares, and why should they? At the end of the day, it all comes down to money when it comes to farming. How much money you got, it determines how much food you can put on, and all things lead from there. So
who else get, because of the rigours of a dairying life? I mean, you know, often musicians sort of say, you know, I'm available for weddings, parties, anything, but you're not quite as flexible as that.
Nah. Luckily, after calving, I can do a few gigs on a Friday or Saturday. And my wife will cover me, but, you know, we don't milk at 7 or 8 at night, so wash my hands and get the guitar and go. But, yeah, you got to get up the next morning, that's the only struggle. But I'm cutting a different track to a lot of farmers do. I'm trying to do it this way. It's not the same as anybody else. Probably everyone's different, eh?
Yeah. So who inspires you?
Who inspires me? One of the songs on the CD, which is actually playing now, is dedicated to my wife, Alison. And without her, I just wouldn't be here, you know. We went out to school together, went to the same school. Yeah, so...
It's a real love story.
This song here called Check Yes or No, and it's just sits real deep. And yeah, we're still together and she's always had my back, and just want to thank her very much.
Dairy farmer Regan Tucker singing the praises of his wife Alison at their farm at Dunorlan near Elizabethtown in northern Tasmania. Rose Grant with that story. This is a Country Breakfast here on RN. I'm Edwina Farley. Next, forget the question, would you like fries with that? What about crickets, the chirping kind?
Well, there's science.
Science.
Music.
Music.
Mayhem and malarkey.
Street life.
Bush life.
Food.
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 History.
Philosophy.
Politics.
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 Funny stuff.
And enough's enough.
If you're curious about everything, so are we. RN Afternoons, 2 hours about everything, with me, Michael McKenzie, 1 till 3 weekdays, and online all the time, right here on RN.
Food fraud and insect shakes. Not normally two things you'd put together, but the brains and research at KPMG's agribusiness unit has been working hard on both. Food fraud and counterfeiting is one of the most alarming trends in modern agribusiness, and with the demand for clean, green food booming amongst Asia's growing middle class, product counterfeiting is also on the rise. The global head of agribusiness at KPMG hopes there'll soon be an international food integrity body to deal with the issue. As part of a speech to industry in New Zealand, Ian Proudfoot also touched on some of the emerging food trends he sees in the marketplace.
So my perspective on counterfeiting is, if you look at the demand for food, what's driving people to counterfeit is the fact that we don't have enough food in the world, and therefore people can secure a premium by effectively rebadging or distorting food that has traditionally been sold in one way and selling it through a different channel to get more money. If you look globally, Interpol, for instance, don't have any remit surrounding food and food integrity at the moment. There isn't really a global body. And as a consequence, it is a real challenge for us how we ensure the integrity of our products. One of the things we need to be focused on as an industry is how we actually position ourselves to create a global movement around food integrity.
Could you tell us a little bit about what are some of the food types that are most counterfeited?
So in particular, from New Zealand's perspective, we have two key risks. One is Manuka honey, which is an incredibly high-value honey program. If you look at that product, we know there's probably 10 times more Manuka honey being sold globally than we actually produce in New Zealand because of people counterfeiting the product. The other key area for us is obviously the gold kiwi fruit, which is a unique product. We've got some intellectual property rights around that product. And there's a lot of rebadging of less high-quality product being done, particularly in Asian markets, to again secure that premium that they have for their kiwi fruit products.
Do you happen to have any stats on what else has been counterfeited around the region generally, other than specifically in New Zealand?
No specific stats. We're actually doing some work around that at the moment.
And you touched on that a lot of that counterfeiting is in Asia. Do we have some key market ideas of where the most counterfeiting is happening?
It tends to be in those markets where there is a bigger premium for natural food, so particularly the Chinese market and some of the ASEAN markets around Southeast Asia, where potentially the intellectual property rights aren't as strong as they are in some countries, but also just where the economic incentive is stronger for people to counterfeit.
The likelihood of political will to get something happening on this, do you think, and a time frame in which it might be possible?
I think, you know, it's clearly something that, from New Zealand government's perspective, protecting the integrity of our food supply is critical. I think also there's a lot of will in a lot of other countries because of the concern about the quality of product their people are being sold. If the product is not high enough quality, then obviously that has health outcomes and other implications. So we see moves across a lot of governments to improve the integrity of their food supply. And my belief is we'll see a movement towards a sort of global food integrity body over the next couple of years.
Do you think it's possible to work something like that into negotiations when you do something like the TPP, for example?
I think in terms of the TPP perspective, it is something that logically the TPP as a structure to discuss issues could therefore take forward. I think also, though, when you look at APEX, another channel of which many, many countries involved and probably those that have some of the bigger integrity issues and therefore greater government incentive to ensure the safety of people's food.
Just on the food trends, there were two that I particularly wanted to pick your mind on. The first one was insects as a form of protein. I wondered if you could explain for us a little of what you said today on that.
So in terms of insects as a form of protein, to me, if you look at the demand for animal proteins and equivalent proteins, they're growing so rapidly that the challenge is producing enough food to feed the animals to produce the protein. If you look at, for instance, insects, they don't need a feedstock. They can survive off any biomass. They're also incredibly efficient converters of biomass into protein. So, you know, they're 48% efficiency compared to a dairy cow, which obviously in New Zealand's our base benchmark, which is about 3% efficiency. They have no environmental footprint, so you don't have any of the effluent challenges. And then if you grind them up, you have a powder, much like, you know, you have from other protein powders. So we think it's logical that there will be a move to substitute particularly lower value uses of animal proteins with alternative proteins. And insects to us is a no-brainer.
You gave an example about a shake in the US, I believe. Could you just tell us a little bit about what you're hearing there?
Yeah, so it's an interesting, there is a fast food company in the States, has about 100 restaurants that have done really, really good business over the last few months by offering a Oreo chocolate protein shake with Chilean crickets as part of the components there, and, you know, claiming a certain number of crickets, I think it's in the 90s, in every protein shake sold. So, you know, it just shows you will do business because it's a component, and you know, you can actually differentiate your product at the moment by using it.
Just finally as well, the other trend that really caught my ear listening to your speech was to do with targeting agribusiness towards key demographics, specifically the silver consumers, I think you were talking about. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
So if you look at the silver population, that's the over 65, there's going to be around 1.1 billion people in that category by 2030. You know, today there's probably about half the people ever to have reached the age of 65 alive. So it is a new part of the population that, you know, 50 years ago really wasn't substantial at all. When you look at that population, they have unique needs for food. They often are managing chronic health conditions. They are potentially suffering from some arthritis or things that make it hard to access packaging. They're probably not moving around so much, so they don't need as much energy in their food. So if you actually think carefully about how you present the products to them, how you package those products, the solutions you bring, you can actually add a huge amount of value to their lives by the food that they eat. You know, it could just be as simple as, you know, the palate's drier. You haven't got as much saliva, so making food slightly more moist is something that can really bring value. So if we're going to unlock, you know, the value of food, we really need to think carefully about how we package it and present it to key consumer groups. And you know, that is a consumer group that has also got wealth because they've spent their lives working and building that wealth. They're happy to spend it. We need to take advantage of those opportunities.
That's KPMG's Global Head of Agribusiness, Ian Proudfoot, speaking with our reporter Lucy Bell in New Zealand. Now, around the world, the trend in healthcare has been to tip millions, possibly billions, into training and rolling out more specialist doctors. But for one small-town American GP, that strategy seems highly misguided because investing in family doctors, especially in rural areas, actually achieves better outcomes for less money. Clint Jasper spoke with Professor Richard Roberts, who says his life experience in rural medicine and a number of studies back that up.
When you look at the most successful health systems in the world, they are built on a very solid foundation of primary care. And to a considerable degree, you've done that here in Australia. Though I might caution that in terms of workforce, you're potentially in for some trouble. You know, as I understand it, about 30% of your doctors are GPs, and the usual recommendation is it should be about 50% specialists and other disciplines and 50% GPs.
You described rural GPs as catalysts in their communities. What did you mean by that?
Well, we have the somewhat unusual position in communities, large and small, but especially in small communities, of seeing everyone, the best and the worst in the community, and seeing them in various states of undress, which has a very kind of equalizing effect to things. And consequently, you have a credibility with people in the community that makes it possible many times for you to help move things along in the community because people trust you. And it's not unique to family doctors. There can be other, you know, sometimes certain school teachers or business leaders. I mean, there are lots of folks that can do this, but Family doctors very often do this. And so we help catalyze things. We help get things moving because we have a perspective. We're listening to what the community has to say, the things that they're struggling with, the loss of a job because a factory closed down, the rise in substance abuse among young people as their mothers come in and express concern.
You also get a more personal insight into some of the biggest health problems facing the whole globe at the moment: obesity, diabetes, heart problems. What can rural GPs, that model of care, offer to those big problems that perhaps specialist care can't?
Well, obesity is a really good example. It's a global issue. But as you try to change community behaviors and attitudes around eating habits, around exercise habits, you have a somewhat unique position of connecting that individual to the larger community effort. And that's what we do. So in our little town, we've had community-wide walking and wellness programs where at one point, 2 out of 3 residents of the area were involved in a formal walking program, keeping track of their miles walked, and actually and it was posted in the weekly newspaper, and they were organized into teams, and you'd have children coming home from school saying, you know, Mom, Janie's team is 3 miles ahead of us. We have to get out and walk today. And so that's the community level. But then the personal level, when somebody would come in, you'd say, you know, I'd like you to get involved with this walking program, and I'd write a prescription, enroll in a walking program. That was the prescription. Because you have the patient's attention. They came to you for help. You're trying to offer them help. Do they act on it every single time? No, but they act on it a reasonable number of times. And so this is what helps to catalyze or move things along in communities.
The picture you're painting of these rural doctors is rural doctors at their best, but quite often they're overworked, they're working around the clock. Does this model only work when it's adequately supported with policy and funding and the people around those doctors?
It works best when it's adequately supported. Do rural GPs always get it right or always perform at their best? Certainly not. No more than urban heart transplant specialists. You know, everybody has their own strengths and weaknesses. In many ways, though, that's sort of looking at it from the wrong angle. I think the better way to think about it is to say, what will it take to do better than we're doing by way of improving the overall community's health? And that has become very clear around the world across all countries, that the stronger you make primary care, the better you invest in it, the better your outcomes, the higher the satisfaction of those receiving services, and the lower the relative cost. It's a very good investment in the future of your community.
What's your best idea for attracting bright, enthusiastic doctors into rural areas? Because getting people there in the first place is one of the most difficult aspects of bringing people out to the country.
You have to expose them to it. People have all kinds of preconceived ideas about what that means, and sometimes they're right, but many times they're wrong. Sometimes they think it means that I never get a moment's rest and it's stress, stress, stress all day long. And in certain situations it can be. For the most part, on the other hand, it's really quite satisfying, quite enjoyable. Your patients look out for you. That's the sense of a mutual, respected, trusted therapeutic relationship. It's not just that I'm taking care of the patients take care of me. So that's the first thing, is expose them to it so they can truly see it. So if you think about it at sort of a community level, at a global level, for that local community, you're going to get much closer to putting all the pieces in place so that people will find an attractive place to be. You know, one of the things you'll find as you go around and visit is that many of these doctors at this meeting have been in their communities for a great many years. If it were all that awful, why hadn't they left years ago to sit on Bondi Beach in Sydney or wherever else they might have gone to? They're finding something sustaining. It's really quite, for me at least, been quite a privilege, but enormously satisfying to take care of the folks in my small community that I've been taking care of for 30 years.
Professor Richard Roberts speaking there with Clint Jasper. And as part of that Rural Medicine Conference on in Adelaide this week, we took a look at whether rural medicine itself has had a major facelift from what was once considered a backwater of second-rate doctors to superstar status enjoyed in the medical community today. 12 years ago, the doctors we're about to hear from had some major reservations about heading bush. Clint Jasper caught up with Dr. Molly Shorthouse, who says she wishes someone had told her all those years ago that she wouldn't be left in the middle of nowhere practicing medicine alone.
I guess you were geographically very isolated in Arnhem Land. We're sort of 700-800 kilometres from Darwin or Cairns. And so medically, when someone gets really sick, it's a bit of time to get them to the tertiary centre. But we have some really incredible GP anaesthetists, GP obstetricians, senior doctors that work in the area and have worked there for some time. And I think that having that level of support behind you and also being able to get on the phone to ICU or really senior expert advice is just invaluable. And I really do feel supported no matter what the distance.
And so is it really the opposite of what you thought it might be, practicing medicine in such a remote part of the country?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a good point, actually. I think as a suburban tertiary centre specialist trainee, in some ways I was less supported. I think that rural general GPs are really, really good at looking after each other, and that comes from a whole lot of personality traits and the type of people that we are, really.
And when you were studying and thinking of career options, was that one of the central fears or hesitations about going and practicing medicine outside of the city?
Possibly. I think there were a lot of things. I think there was this sort of culture that if you went rural, you were a second-rate doctor when I went through 12 years ago. And I'm really, really excited that that's changed, because to now be really proud to say that you're a rural doctor and a rural generalist is something exciting for new students and doctors.
Scott Lewis, you practice medicine at Woodna on the Eyre Peninsula. It's a small country town. You spoke to the crowd today about setting boundaries between your practice and your role as a doctor and as someone's mate in the town. So how did you go about establishing those rules, and did you arrive with them, or is it something that you kind of had to work out for yourself as you went along?
One of the things about working in small rural areas is it's always inevitable that you're going to treat your friends and at times potentially you have to treat your family. That's not an ideal thing. It's certainly well recognised there should be boundaries in that relationship between a doctor and a patient, but that's not always possible. So I've always found it's extremely important to make sure that those boundaries are well defined. And one of the best ways of doing that is making a very clear demarcation between your personal life and your professional life. And when I went through training, there were lots of stories about doctors who'd sutured up people's arms on their kitchen table and people coming to their doors, and that sort of thing isn't something I'm comfortable with. I've always maintained that my life outside of work is my life, and thankfully I've got a population that is very, very respectful of that.
Bouncing off that fear or hesitation about working out there practicing medicine alone is the fact that you might end up quite overworked going around the clock dealing with people as they call in. Has that been the case?
It's always potentially the case, but once again, it's something I've always tried very, very hard to mitigate. And really, it comes back to having such a supportive community as I do, in that if I have a very, very busy night, then they are very understanding if I then cancel a morning's consulting, or if I have to pack up and run off to a car accident at you know, 0 minutes' notice. They're also very, very understanding of the necessity to cancel their appointments and shift them to another day. The other side of that is yes, I've been able to actually tailor my hours, and in times when I felt like I was being a bit overworked, I've been able to cut down some of my consulting time, and people are very understanding of that.
And I just wanted to bounce off you something that Molly said, that change in perception about practicing rural medicine is something that second-rate doctors did to now something that superstar doctors take up as a career path. Have you noticed that over your career and how significant that change has been?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I trained at the exact same time as Molly did, but obviously in two different parts of the country. And when I went through, certainly general practice had a fairly low reputation, unfortunately, and working in rural areas even less so. Indeed, when I went into general practice training in 2004, I was one of two applicants for 9 rural positions. But now we're in a situation where we have 2 to 3 times as many applicants for each position in general practice training. So the overall status of it has dramatically improved over the last 12 years.
Dr. Scott Lewis from Woodna on South Australia's Eyre Peninsula, speaking there with Clint Jasper. Well, I hope you've enjoyed the program this week. All of those stories can be found at our website, abc.net.au/rural. That's where you can also find a link to podcast this program. Thanks to Brendan O'Neill for technical production this week, and thanks to you for tuning in. Bye for now.